Okay. So your question is, if you're feeling soreness or pain in your body, and then you focus your attention on the soreness or the pain, then sometimes it becomes very intense. That you're asking, so what do you do then when that happens? Okay. What is really important is the way that you look at the soreness and the pain, because you want to look at it as objectively as you can, as if it's something separate from you. And when you look at it, initially you're going to be experiencing it the way we always experience pain. Oh, this is my pain. This hurts. I don't like this. Right? And so the point of directing your attention to it is to try to get away from that identifying with it, and instead examine it objectively, as though you were separate from it. So when you put your attention to the soreness, maybe it's a soreness in your knee, for example, I'll just use that as an example, you might put your attention on it and say, how large is it? Is it getting larger or smaller, or is it fluctuating? What is the quality of it? Is it dull aching, or is it burning, or is it sharp? And is the quality of it changing? Is it moving, or is it staying in the same place? So you're looking at it in this way, with these kinds of questions in your mind, helps to put you into an objective relationship with the pain. Now, it is normal that when you first begin to focus on an unpleasant sensation, it's going to become more intense just because you're looking at it. Right? Is that what you mean, that just because you're looking at it, it's more intense?
Correct.
Correct, okay. And that's normally what happens. And that's what you want to work with. You want to work with that, because you see what is happening there is that it's your mind's reaction to the sensation that's making it more intense.
So you're saying, without concentrating on part of the body, don't feel anything. But once you concentrate, immediately you feel very vibration and, you know, painful, very strong feeling. It's because you're concentrating some part of the body, so the other part you won't feel.
Because all of your attention's on that one part. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Mm-hmm. But the thing is that you have to ask yourself, why when I put my attention in this, does it become more unpleasant? Ask yourself that question. And what that leads to, what you want it to lead to, what you want your examination of pain to eventually take you to, is the experience of understanding the relationship between pain and suffering. And that's a very important thing to learn. Because, you know, the Buddha taught four noble truths, four truths. The first truth that he taught, I don't know if people really understand it very well. He said, basically, the way that I would put that first truth is that pain is inevitable, but suffering is optional. But the way we start out, we all suffer. Whenever there's pain, we suffer because of it. But that doesn't have to be the case. It doesn't have to be that way. The pain is a physical sensation. And yes, it is unpleasant. But it is our mind's reaction to it that causes it to be suffering and that makes it more unpleasant. So while your attention is on your breath and your awareness of the pain is in the background of your mind is reacting against it. And so you're experiencing some degree of suffering. And then when you put your attention directly on it, now your mind is resisting this experience much more strongly. And so it becomes more intense. And what you would like to do using pain as a part of your practice, what you would like to do is to discover through your own direct experience how it is that your mind turns an unpleasant sensation into a miserable experience, into suffering.
Well, my immediate reaction is that how come the bell doesn't ring?
Yeah, right. Yeah. And, you know, and what would happen if you could see the clock? You know, I don't know if you can, but if you can see the clock, you have a pain, and you think, oh, I hope the bell rings soon, because this is really bothering me. Then if you look at the clock and you see, oh, there's 15 minutes to go, it hurts worse. It hurts worse just because you know there's a long time. You know, that in itself tells you it is your mind. Your mind is part of the experience of the suffering. So yeah, the first thing that you want is you want the pain to end. And of course, the idea will come to do something to make the pain end. And if you deny that to yourself, you say, no, I'm going to sit still until the bell rings, then two things. You're either going to sit there and your mind is going to resist this and resist it, and it's going to bother you more and more, or else you're going to stop resisting it and you're just going to be there with it and accept it, and then it's going to not bother you so much. Life is full of unpleasantness. That's just the nature of it. There's physical pain and there's all of the other kinds of unpleasantness that are in life. And the quality of our life depends on how we react to the unpleasantness. And the more we resist it, the more we're going to suffer because of it. So when you have a pain in meditation, it's an opportunity to work on this. Now, my advice is that you do your best not to move, and when you need to focus on the pain because your attention it keeps being drawn away to it, then you focus on it for as long as you can. You try to, you ask yourself, what is it about this that makes it painful? Can I just relax and accept it? Can I be with it? And try to learn to do that. But if at some point you realize that you can't stand it anymore, then of course it's all right to move. But move mindfully. But the thing that you'll notice, I'm sure you already know this, but not everybody does, and that is that if there's a discomfort and then you move, it relieves it, but only very, very temporarily, for a very short time. And then either the same pain comes back or some different pain comes. And so you move again, and that relieves it again, but not even for as long as the first time did, until after a little while you're constantly moving. You know. And that's just the way it works. So you're better off to look at the discomfort as an opportunity to practice not resisting pain, but accepting it and learning to deal with it. If you do that, you reach a point where you'll basically be free from pain, at least the worst sources of suffering, in every aspect of your life. You won't experience pain the way that you used to and the way that most people do. Is that sound possible to you?
No. Question.
Yeah.
When you say acceptance, the other one resistance. Now, what kind of my reaction you consider resistant and then acceptance?
Okay, the mental reaction, there's two problems. One is that you identify with it, you say, I am in pain. My knee hurts, I hurt. Something like that, you identify with it. And the second problem is there is a very strong feeling, I don't want this. I want this to go away. I want this to stop. I want to do something to make this stop. That's resisting it. So So there's identifying with it and there's resisting it. To counter it, you want, first of all, to be objective and say, ah, there is pain, not I have pain, but there is pain in the leg. And examine this, the quality of this pain, as I described before. That's the first thing. To try not to say, oh, this is my pain. Now that's related to the second part, because when the thought is there, I hurt, my leg hurts, then the next thought that follows after that is, I want it to stop, I want to do something, I need to change something, I can't stand this, so forth. And so that's where the resistance comes in. So the resistance is related to identifying with it. So when you start looking at it objectively, then you can start also replacing the thought that I can't stand this, it hurts, I need to do something, replace those thoughts with thoughts of, okay, I'll just be with it, I'll let it be there, I'll watch it. I won't try to make it go away. I'll stop having thoughts about how I want it to go away.
What if you say, okay, no matter what happened, I will sit the whole session finish. Is that acceptance?
If you say to yourself something like, even if this lasts for the whole sit, I don't mind. I'm not going to resist it. That's non-resistance. If you're saying, even if it lasts for the whole sit, that's all right. It might not be true. It might be that at some point you'll say, okay, I really can't stand it anymore and now I'm going to move. But the attitude that if it wants to be there for the whole time, it can be there for the whole time. I'll let it. That's the attitude of not resisting. And it doesn't even matter whether it's not true or not. It's true in the moment. So in that moment, you'll know that you're succeeding in this when the pain doesn't bother you as much. And the surprising thing is that sometimes it just goes away. It just becomes another sensation. And you say, oh, well, it's just an unpleasant sensation, but it doesn't bother me anymore. And then you go back to the breath. That you'll know that you'll have succeeded. That takes some time, though. That takes some practice. But that is the place that you'll get to.
So CC, the question of CC is a very, very typical example. Now we have a sensation feeling, yeah, such as the pain feeling.
Yes.
Now we have suffering.
That's right.
Okay, those two is independent fact, independent truths.
Yeah.
But in order to turn the pain feeling or sensation into the suffering,
yeah,
you need something between, which is our mind.
That's right.
And our mind response determine how it turns to that.
Exactly.
So yes. No matter what you methodology, or no matter what you think, or your judgment, what you did, in any way, they will turn the sensation or the pain feeling to suffering. So the best way is become neutral.
Yeah.
Become neutral. Become neutral.
Becomes neutral, yeah.
Neutral. Become neutral.
Yeah.
The CC say I don't mind is not neutral because you say you don't mind.
You say don't mind is not neutral?
Not neutral because you make judgment, so you're not neutral.
Okay.
You make judgment.
Acceptance, okay.
Am I right? Yeah. So the best way is neutral. Like an independent mind to see what it happened. If eventually they turn to the pain feeling, then we see how the suffering interact my mind to the pain feeling. Just neutral to watch. Is this okay? Or is this otherwise we try to seek,
yeah,
an efficiency way to deal with it, which is like you say, acceptance or resistance. But every people interpret in different way.
That's
so
right.
The best way is a neutral. Well, neutral to watch, mindful awareness to watch,
yeah,
the relation between pain feeling and the suffering, and you just stand between. Is this okay?
Yes. And what you're saying
turn
is...
Turn to skill. If this is okay, yeah. Then to turn to the daily practice skill. What is the skill? Okay. Do you have any idea?
The skill that we're talking about is called equanimity. It's like equanimity.
Okay.
Yeah. See, what you're... If I were to say, I don't mind, that's what I would think of as being neutral, but different people would interpret it in different ways, you're right. Yeah. But it's neutral in the sense that you're not trying to get rid of it, you're not trying to hold on to it, it's just you're being completely neutral to it. And that's what equanimity is. That's not grasping, not clinging, not pushing away, not aversion. It's just a completely neutral reaction. It's non-reaction. It's not reacting.
Non-reaction.
Yeah, it's non-reaction.
Non-reaction.
Non-reaction. But it's, because the reaction is where the problem is.
Because, like a CC example, the pain from the body when you meditate is not too complicated. Because in real life, it's more complicated. Turn some kind of feeling to suffering.
That's right.
But this body pain is more simple.
Yeah.
That you can know how to deal. But in real life, probably you lost your conscience. Mm-hmm. So now the question is, in terms of skill, daily practice skill, try to see whether any people has this kind of experience skill to share regarding how to become neutralized reaction.
Well, meditation is practice for daily life. And so if we just look in terms of pain, the wonderful thing about pain in meditation is that it goes away like that. If if you decide that you can't stand anymore, you stand up and it's gone, right? Or you move and it's gone. Whereas in real life, if you have an injury or if you have a sickness or something like that, you can't make the pain go away that way. Right? So it's wonderful to have the opportunity to practice in meditation dealing with pain, because the pain is just, it's just there to practice on, that's all. Whereas in real life, you don't have the same control over it. The same thing is true of everything else in your life. All of the different ways that, at least in terms of our negative reactions, that we resist things, that we dislike things, that we become angry at things, that we become impatient, annoyed, or that we experience suffering because, mental suffering, because things don't happen the way we want them to. Those things happen in meditation as well, all in a situation where you have complete control over it. In meditation, you get restless. In meditation, you can be experience dissatisfaction and all of these other things. So that's the place to begin your practice at recognizing. The first thing is you have to recognize that what it is that your mind is doing that's creating the problem. It's like when you first look at the pain, and looking at the pain causes it to get worse, now you have to look at it to understand why that's happening so that you can change it. And that's the first step in everything else. When something happens in your life that is emotionally painful or disappointing to you, you have to recognize that it's not the thing that happened that's the problem. It's the way your mind is reacting to it. That's the first thing that you have to recognize. And then, with those skills that you have learned while sitting, then you can try to let go of that reaction. And sometimes you can only let go of it for a moment, or a few moments. But when you do, you'll find that the suffering that it's producing in you is gone as well. So you work with it. Now, if you waited only until some major painful instance happens in your life, you might find that you're not really prepared to deal with it very effectively. So, of course, the best way to develop this skill is just like working out with weights. You start out with a small weight, and then as you get stronger, you use a bigger one. With the same thing, that you be mindfully aware of your reactions to all kinds of little things every day. And you practice on those little things, recognizing your mind's reactions that are creating the problem, causing some little bit of suffering, dissatisfaction. And then you practice letting go of that, reminding yourself, oh, I don't have to do this. I don't have to get upset. I can let go of that thing. So you practice on the little things. Then when something big comes along, you find that you have much more skill in being able to deal with it.
You said let it go, it means let it happen, don't react. What change your reaction? What hold your reaction?
Well,
what to see?
Okay, that's a good question. What do we mean by letting it go? Mm-hmm. Okay, the main thing to let go of are the ideas and the beliefs that you have that are causing you to react in that way. And fundamentally, if you think about it, when something goes wrong in your life and you begin to get upset, there is a sort of belief that that's the only way it could be. You know, that the nature of this thing is such that anybody would get upset about it. Of course I'm upset about it. Of course it makes me happy. It would make anybody unhappy. But that is a belief. That's a belief that you can't do anything about your emotional reactions. And that's a false belief. But it's a very deep-seated belief. And so that's what you have to begin by working on. When you let go of that belief, then the belief that you can't help feeling this way, then that allows you to work on letting go of the feeling. By looking and saying, well, having this kind of reaction is not helping the situation, it's just making me feel worse than the situation is already. Created more problems than the situation already does. When you can recognize that, when you see that, for example, when you find that, okay, getting angry is just going to spoil the whole rest of my day, then that makes it easier for you to look at this and say, well, do I need to hold on to this angry feeling? I know that I don't have to, and I can see that it's only going to hurt me more if I do hold on to it. Then you have the opportunity to let go of the emotion. You look at the situation, there may be something that you can do about the situation that is productive and useful. And letting go doesn't mean not doing that, but it means not being attached to the result. You do the best that you can. You do whatever it is that you can do. But you stop resisting what is. Because most especially you stop believing that you have to suffer because of whatever it is that's happened. That's where the real letting go is.
So apply the series to the pain feeling. Apply the series to the pain feeling.
To the pain feeling, yeah.
The same thing.
Yeah, that's right. It's exactly the same thing. You start off with the belief that pain is something outside of your mind and your mind has nothing to do with it. It's my body that's causing the pain and there's nothing I can do about it. The first thing you have to do is to discover that your mind is involved in the suffering. The body is only producing the sensation. The mind's doing everything else. And so it's exactly the same thing. You have to overcome that conviction, that you're convinced that this is true. So this is why you have to experiment with pain, examine pain, and work with pain until you begin to discover that, yes, it is my reaction to it. Then that weakens the belief that there's nothing you can do about it. But that's what, I mean, everybody had when they have pain, that's the belief that underlies the suffering they have, is, well, I can't do anything about this. And of course, some people, they'll listen to me talk and say this, and they'll say, I don't believe it, there's nothing I can do about it. I've had pain before, and once I've got pain, I've got pain. And it's natural to believe that. All I can do is say, please, please try to work with it and discover that that belief is not true. Then, when you get past the belief, then you can see if you can change the mind's attitude towards it. And then you'll experience the difference. It is exactly what the Buddha taught when he taught the Four Noble Truths. The very first teaching that he gave was this truth about the relationship between pain and suffering, and that all of our suffering comes, you know, the second truth is that all of our suffering comes from craving. But by craving, we mean desire and aversion, which, if you think about it, that means wanting things to be different than the way they are, not accepting the way things are in the moment, right now, and instead resisting that. That's the cause of all your suffering, wanting something you don't have, not wanting what you do have, things like that. And so, when he gave this teaching, part of the second truth is that when you discover that you have, that you're suffering for any reason, you look to your mind to see where the craving is. Where is the desire and where is the aversion that is feeding the suffering? And when you can find that, then you let go of it. You identify it and you let go of it. And when you do that, you'll find that the suffering ends. As I say, and as the Buddha said, it will only end temporarily, maybe just for a brief moment. But the more you do this, the deeper the understanding and the conviction will be that if you could stop all craving, all suffering would stop. And that's where you move to the third truth. The complete end of craving equals the complete end of suffering, because all suffering arises from craving. But you have to convince yourself of this. You can't just hear somebody say it and then stop craving, because the natural resistance we have to things is so strong that it needs to be worked on. You need to learn to recognize it, you need to let go of it, you need to let go of it over and over again until you get to the point where you're totally convinced, and then you're ready to move to the third truth, the final release.
Yeah. Okay. Anybody have a question?
Oh, it's okay.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
You're asking good questions.
Okay.
I think has a question.
Well, not really a question, but it seems to me where this is kind of leading is this idea of going from pain to suffering, basically. Another element is this idea of a self. Like,
that's right.
You know, I'm the one who's in pain. I'm the one who doesn't want this, versus just, oh, it's just a mental state popping up and going away.
That is exactly right. And that's why, in order to deal effectively with pain and suffering, you need to practice being objective. Because long before you reach the point where you have realized the truth that there is no self behind this, long before you reach that point, you can still work very effectively with unpleasant emotions and unpleasant sensations and things like that by taking an objective stance and not identifying with them. So when there's fear, if you think, I am afraid, you're paralyzed. But if you think, fear is arising in me, and you look at it objectively, you have a much greater possibility of dealing with it effectively and not being overwhelmed by it. And it's true of absolutely every emotion. That identification with it is at the root. And as the Buddha taught us, desire and aversion always are connected to ignorance. And what is the ignorance? The ignorance is the belief that we are a substantial separate self, and that we live in a world that is independently real and is the way we perceive it to be. That is the ignorance. And so to achieve the final cessation of craving, you have to overcome that ignorance. That's where insight practice comes in. You gain insight into emptiness, you gain insight into no self, you gain insight into the fact that so long as you believe in the self that you think you are going to suffer. And those insights bring you to the point of recognizing in a very profound, deep way, deep in your heart, that I am not the separate self that I feel like I am. And when you have that realization, then craving no longer has the same power over you. Desire and aversion don't have the same power. And now you're well on the way to the permanent end of craving, which is the permanent end of suffering. But it's not like you have to wait till then. Because you can start in this very moment by not identifying with your moods, with your emotions, with your pain, and instead separating the sense of I from those things, leaving the sense of I. The sense of I is still there, but leave it somewhere in the background and just deal with what's actually happening in the moment rather than getting into I am this, I have this, this is happening to me. Because that feeds the craving, it feeds the resistance, it feeds the suffering. So you were ready to add something else.
Yeah, we're talking about the second truth. Why if we cannot identify the problem? What is the second truth? I forgot. What is the second truth?
The second truth is that when you suffer, there is craving.
Okay. When you suffer, it's because you're craving. And you're talking about, so you need to identify in your mind what you're craving for. But usually, we don't know what we're craving for. We just, for no reason, because we are unable to identify like.
Yeah.
As we discussed, the way we respond to the pain feeling, the only way we believe the only way to respond to the pain feeling turn out to become suffering, right? And the first step is to identify that, to believe this is not the only way.
Yeah.
This is not the only belief. We have another choice. But what if we don't have any idea or experience to what kind of other belief? Like the same situation, what if you cannot identify what you're craving for under the stage? Is there any way can go further or just stuck there?
It's something
too complicated?
No, it's not too complicated. It's it's something that you do have to learn. And you have to, if there is a kind of suffering and you're not able to identify the craving that's behind that suffering. The good side, you might not think this is the good side, but the good side is that the suffering will continue to be there, so you can keep looking to see what the craving is until finally you can understand it. And the more often you do this with the more different kinds of things, the easier it's going to be for you to see the craving. It is a skill. It comes with practice. The other thing that helps is to understand better how the mind works. So if you study Buddhist teachings and you listen to wise teachers who know what they're talking about, they give you information, they give you tips and ideas that you can use to help identify the different kinds of craving. Because when we started off, the idea of craving, we're not sure exactly what it is. And, well, we know what greed is, we know what lust is, and we know what hate is. That's clear. But we don't not able to recognize all these other more subtle forms of craving that are also there. Because we haven't thought about them, so they're alien to us. They're not very clear to us. So through good teachings, we gain a better understanding. And then through continuing to look into ourselves, we begin to understand all these subtler forms of craving that are present. Because what you will discover is that there is almost no moment during your day where there isn't some degree of some form of craving. It's so much a part of us. But initially, it's very difficult to see that.
So, simply speaking, it is important to understand that you have craving in your mind.
Yeah.
Okay. That's very important that you only believe to respond. Whatever situation turn out to become the suffering is not the only belief. If you realize that, it seems you're already on the right track.
Yes, you're on
the right track. To pursue. Okay. Even you don't identify further belief. Identify further craving is still okay. As long as you identify this as the issue, then you are on the right track.
You're that's on the right patient. Track. That's right.
Meditation. Don't hurry, right?
Okay.
That's a good answer.
Yeah. Meditation is such good training, because after all...
So someday they will come. Someday they will come.
Yeah, someday it will come. There's nothing more simple than sit still and watch your breath. And if your mind goes somewhere else, you just gently bring it back. What could be more simple than that? But we when we sit down to do it, we make it very complicated and very difficult. So it's a good way to train. You have to ask yourself, what am I doing that's making this so complicated and so difficult?
So as long as you recognize this is an issue, it means at least your damage is under control.
Yeah.
Right?
That's right.
You don't become Buddha, but your damage is under control because you recognize the issue.
Yeah, you recognize the issue.
You become a Buddha, you need to go for it. To identify the craving.
Yeah. That's Mike.
I have a lot of clinging to this body. You know, I try to protect it. It's very delicate. It's easily damageable, and one day it's going to die. But the thing is, despite the clinging of it, if I focus my attention on, say, virtue, then all of a sudden the clinging for the body is lessened. I feel like, you know, for virtue, for certain kind of ideals, I'm willing to risk my life. But then this is still, clinging to different kind of ideas of myself. You know, this is, I cling onto the body, I cling onto this ideal that I perceive as, you know, my understanding. It just seems like it's just kind of is there any way that we can gradually free ourselves from these kind of clinging? Because any kind of clinging ultimately will still cause us suffering.
Well, it's very important that we try to free ourselves of all these different sorts of clinging. And the first thing, as with what we were just talking about, the first step in anything is recognizing that it's there, recognizing when the clinging is present.
It's very gross. It's like the clinging for life is very, very gross. It's like for like a one little finger, I'm willing to do a lot to protect this little finger.
Yeah. Yeah. But at the same time, you know, the clinging to life is gross, but at the same time, you know with absolute certainty that this body is going to die.
Exactly. So
and you know with absolute certainty, no matter how you try to protect it, it's going to become old and it's going to develop diseases. But it's just, it's the fact. Right? And our clinging to it is a denial of that fact. Or an attempt to deny it. You know, the clinging to the body is, the clinging to life comes from the desire, the wish, the craving to make this not true, to deny it. Can you see what?
Yeah, it's like you want to believe in Santa Claus.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's a wonderful story.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, you go to great lengths to prepare to protect this one little finger, which might even cause you to do things that are harmful to other people, seriously harmful to them, to protect yourself. And whether it's your body or your idea of yourself, your ego, this is what happens all the time, is that we're willing to sacrifice all kinds of things, especially other people, for the sake of our bodies and ourselves, right? But the only reason that we're willing to do that is that we're in that place of trying to deny the reality that deep down we already know is true. If we take the complete other tack and say, well, I'll take the absolute best care of this body I can, but I know it's not going to last. And I know I'm going to fail in the end. And all I can do is what's most reasonable. Then you don't have anywhere near the same compulsions associated with it. And strangely enough, you can even enjoy the things that happen to this body. The negative things that happen to this body. I know there's other things we can enjoy that happen to this body, but you can take a completely different attitude. By enjoy, I don't mean that you know, if you have a disease that you're taking pleasure in the disease, but it's like if you're not resisting it, then it is what it is, and it's the reality of your life, and there isn't anything else but what's happening right now. And so you're totally with it, and you experience it fully.
Can you analyze a little bit further on the resistance? Because, you know, for me to resist is not because I don't believe I'm gonna... It's not because I believe that I'm going to live forever. It's just that I don't like the fact that I'm going to die. I don't like the fact that I'm going to get sick.
Right.
I don't like it, but I know it's going to happen. You know, therefore I resist. So this resistance, how do we eradicate it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish I could give you some magic, simple formula that would do it automatically, but... If you persist in this practice and studying the Dharma, if you keep doing the things that you're doing, you know, I know you, and I know that the things you're doing are the right things, you're going to come to that place. And the funny thing is, you'll get to that place without even realizing you've gotten to that place until something happens. I'll tell you a personal story. 2 months ago, on February 11th, I went into the emergency room. I had severe abdominal pain. I had for about a week. First thing I'll tell you is that I didn't even know how severe the pain was. It turned out that I had an intestinal obstruction, which they say is one of the most painful things that a person can have. And I didn't know how painful it was. Because I just looked at it, and I relaxed with it, and I accepted it. And so, you know, that's probably why I didn't go to the hospital for a whole week, in the emergency room. But anyway, I went to the emergency room, and they did a CAT scan, and they said, you have an intestinal obstruction, and the surgeon comes in and says, I want to operate. And he said to me, What I'm concerned about is that you've never had abdominal surgery before. And I said, why is that? And he said, because most of the time when somebody has an obstruction, it's because of scar tissue, because they've had a previous surgery. And if it's not that, it's almost always malignancy. And, you know, I said, well, what kind of malignancy? And he said, well, could be melanoma, could be sarcoma, listed a couple of other things. I used to teach pathology, and so I realized that, I recognized that the ones he were telling me, they're the worst kinds of malignancies that you can have. And I also remembered that, yes, cancer almost never starts in the small intestine. And most of the common cancers don't even spread to the small intestine. The ones that do are these really bad ones. And he said to me, I think that's what I'm going to find. When I go in, I think I'm going to find one of these. You know. And he said, so the decision is up to you. What do you want to do? And the other thing is that I had always, for years, I said, I'd never had surgery or anything like that. I thought, well, if I have to have surgery ever, you know, if hypothetical, well, if somebody told me you have cancer and have to have surgery, I thought, I might just, you know, go ahead and die rather than have surgery. But here I was in exactly that situation. I remember telling that to Nancy in the past and things like that. And I thought, well, what? This is what's happening. You know, there's people I care about and people who care about me. And there's no choice. This is what's happening. And my attitude was, it was almost like, this is going to be an interesting adventure. You know, so I'm going to go into surgery. You know, and the surgeon said, depending on how much intestine we have to remove, you might have an ostomy. You know what that is? That's where you have a bag on the outside because, you know, not enough intestines to go up. And so there I was, for several hours, you know, with nothing to think about, but when I wake up from the surgery, it might turn out that I have some sort of incurable malignancy, and I might even have an ostomy, a bag hanging out of my belly for a waste, body waste to go into. But I discovered at that time that I didn't have any resistance to this. It was just, it was okay.
Why?
Well, and it was good. Because otherwise, what would I have done in those few hours before the surgery? Lay there on a cart and worried about it? And been afraid of this or that? Or instead, I had this blessed, wonderful experience of just, okay, this is the way it is. We're doing the best thing that we can. There's no point in me saying, oh, no, I'm not going to have surgery. You know, he said, it's your choice. And I said, it doesn't sound like much of a choice to me. No, it was the only thing to do. I didn't have to think about it or worry about it. It was just obvious. And it was all right. And as it turned out, after the surgery, it wasn't malignancy. And, of course, I don't have a bag hanging off my belly. So it's wonderful. It's like, I had this death sentence, and I discovered that it was not a problem. And then I got this reprieve. So now, every day I have is like, you know, it's a bonus, it's a gift, right? So, you know, that's where it goes. That's where it goes to. It goes to the place where, you know, you can function optimally and you don't get devastated by things that happen to you. And you don't become overwhelmed by your emotions.
You know, I use a lesser technique. When I think about virtue, I'm less afraid of death. Because I know virtue is more important in life. And, yeah. And therefore, you know, I'm less afraid of it. But then it's still an idea that I'm clinging on to. But what about you? What do you use? Just a deeper understanding of reality.
Well, I don't feel so separate from everything else. I'm, you know, there is a wonderful whole. Very often, the kind of thoughts I have are that it's just that everything is perfect and I'm part of it. There's no reason to fight against it or resist it. Everything that happens that we might look at and think that it's bad is actually, at the deepest level, it's really perfect. And if we understand that, then we're not fighting against it. Virtue comes into it as sort of an automatic result of that. When you realize the interconnectedness of everything and everyone, there's, you know, virtue becomes automatic. Anything that you would do which would be harmful to somebody else is like doing it to yourself. You know, would you do something, would you cut off your nose to spite your face? As there's a saying that goes, to cut off your nose to spite your face. Meaning what it, referring to a totally ridiculous act. And that's what it becomes like, to behave non-virtuously would be a totally ridiculous thing to do. It becomes, it's just, it doesn't make any sense anymore at any level. So virtue just automatically comes out of a deeper understanding of the way things are. The more you deepen that understanding, and it's not just intellectual understanding, because you can read about it and you can think about it, and that's good and that it's helpful, but it doesn't make the really deep change. The really deep change comes as a result of understanding it at the deepest level of your being, you know, in your heart, just knowing this truth. And then out of that comes love and compassion and virtue automatically. Just like a gift, it's there.
When you said everything is perfect, it sounds like 100% contentment in your mind. But then, you know, I think for you it's perfect, but for the rest of us it's not perfect at all, because it's a struggle. You know, people, I mean, 99.999% of the people don't like to die.
But still, my life is still full of struggle. But I think it's just my attitude towards the struggle is different. The struggle is perfect too. I may not understand, you know, and I can't say that I understand how everything is perfect. It's just I know that it is, and so I know I don't need to fight against it. I know my job is to be the best I can, to do the best I can in every moment. That's my job. That's the only thing that I have to be concerned with, is to do the very best I can. And if tomorrow it turns out that what I did is not good enough, I don't need to be upset, because I did what I could. And it was perfect to do what I did. So therefore, it's perfect that things might not have turned out the way I hoped they would. Make sense?
But look, what if it doesn't turn out what you...
The what?
What if it doesn't turn out like what you expect? No.
If things don't turn out...
Yeah, it doesn't turn out that as you expect. How can that be perfect?
Yeah.
That's the reason why everyone struggles.
Well, see, that's what I was trying to explain, is that if things don't turn out the way they expect, the way that I expect them to, but if I know that I was doing the best that I was capable of, then it must be meant to be that way, and it must be perfect, and I don't need to worry about it. I just need to keep on doing the best that I can, and being the best that I can.
So first of all, you have to know what your limit is.
Yes, first of all.
Because everyone expects my best would be better than better than what I expect.
Yeah, that's true. And part of our problem is that we place expectations on ourselves. We think, I should be capable of doing this. And then we're in that situation, and it turns out we're not capable of doing that, and we judge ourselves. But that's not accepting the way things really are. The way things really are is that we all have limitations. And on the one hand, what's so important is on the one hand, you always do your best. On the other hand, you accept that your best may not be good enough. But it's all right.
But sometimes, you know, because of the lack of ability and the heaviness of the responsibility, if you make a mistake, sometimes there's huge consequences. There could be tens of thousands of people dead because of it. Say, for example, if somebody who's designing a dam and then, you know, there's some miscalculation, the dam bursts and thousands of people get killed. I mean, this person did his best, but then it's still very tragic.
So then that person, as I see it, that person has two options. One, they can be so overwhelmed with guilt that they commit suicide. Or the other is that they say, well, I did my best, but the dam failed, so now let me do my best for whatever is possible to help with the situation that now exists. You keep on doing your best. If somebody, you know, it's a very traditional thing in Japan, for example, that if you're in charge of a dam and it breaks, you know, you should. Right? But does that help anybody? Does that make anything
so
anybody?
A lot of people will be satisfied. Satisfaction.
Well, what it will do is, you know, if someone has hatred in their heart because they held you responsible, and you do that, and then they feel satisfaction, what they're doing is they're harming themselves. So I think that in that situation that you committed suicide, you'd actually be making it possible for all those people that blamed you to harm themselves by indulging in, by taking satisfaction in your misfortune and your death.
Well, the option for these people is to hate this person for the rest of their life. I mean, or they just get like a really bad satisfaction and it's over.
Well, I don't know how to weigh those two options.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I got carried away.
Yeah. So, well, as far as I can go with it, is I don't see anything's gained by blaming yourself. Like if you did something and there was a failure because you say, you know, out of greed, you didn't use the proper materials and it affected people seriously, then you do have a responsibility, right? You have the responsibility to do whatever you can to make that right. And perhaps you even have the responsibility to admit to the people affected that you were the one responsible and that you did this thing. But at the same time, what happened yesterday is over and done with. It's set in concrete. It can't be changed. Yesterday is gone. The only thing we can work with is the present, and it's the present that creates the future. So no matter what you did yesterday, unless you've got a time machine, and I don't, you can't go back and change it. You have to look ahead and say, what can I do now? And even to your last breath, there's probably something that you can do that's good and a benefit. So that's what you should do.
Well, probably it's not a good analogy that, you know, in the legal world, everyone going back or are in the present time, you know, or going into a future, change the past. Now, what I mean is that everyone says that there's no fact, only your truth or my truth, but no one holds the truth.
Yes, everybody has their own truth, yes. And the fact is that we can't do anything about anybody else's truth. But we're totally responsible for our own truth.
So I mean that in that kind of situation that, if someone is either honest or doesn't twist or change or something, it sometimes actually hurt that person.
Yeah.
So in that kind of situation, how you deal with yourself or how?
Yeah. Well, if somebody does something that hurts somebody else, they do have a responsibility to do whatever they can to make amends or to make reparations. And that is part of their personal truth. They can deny that. And I think in the legal system, that's what happens. People deny their responsibility and they try to refuse to do, rather than dealing with their own personal truth. And so you end up with different people with their different versions of reality, and you have to bring in a judge to decide who's right, and lawyers to make the best case for each side. But it wouldn't happen. That wouldn't be necessary if people had a greater sense of virtue, and if people could come from a place of just simply saying that I need to do the best that I can do in every situation. You can do something that hurts somebody, and it's not possible to do anything at all to undo that. Sometimes that's the case. A person without a penny to their name can cause damage to somebody that costs $10 million. And there's nothing they can do about that. But the point is that you can't change the past. This person, while they're alive and while they're breathing, can try to be the best person that they are capable of and do the best that they can do in every way. And that's the place that I'd like everyone to come to. It would be wonderful. We would live in a totally different world if everybody came from that place. Don't you think?
Yes.
Yeah.
How the meditation help for you to make sure you try your best at any moment?
Well, this gets to, we're now getting to the fourth noble truth, which is that with right view, right understanding, and the practice of virtue in your life, plus the practice of meditation, concentration, and mindfulness, you can reach the place where there's a complete cessation of craving. You can make these kinds of changes in yourself. How that works is, in meditation, you're developing the ability, as you know, to be aware of your own mind and your reactions to what's actually happening moment to moment. You come to know that in a very direct way. And that leads to insight. First of all, it leads to what we call mundane insight. You start to understand better who you are, what you are, and your relationship to the world. And that alters things dramatically. If you're practicing virtue, like the precepts and the practice of the perfections, these are just guidelines. Before we get to the place where virtue comes from inside of us, these are the guidelines to follow so that we can act as though we already have that degree of wisdom. So, but the more you act as though you already have that degree of wisdom, the easier it becomes to understand the way things really are. You know, if you act, if you avoid harming others and taking what's not freely given, and any sort of sexual or other misconduct in your relationships with other people, and if you avoid any sort of wrong speech that would cause harm to other people, if you do those things, you're acting as a person would, who has the wisdom of understanding that we're all interconnected, and that anything that you do that violates those precepts is actually harming yourself as well. That makes it easier for you to see this truth. Because if instead you are doing things that harm others, you are taking things for your benefit that are to the detriment of others, you know, if you are manipulative and abusive in your relationship, all of these things, the only reason you do these things is out of your ignorance, your attachment to your own sense of self and well-being, and your own desires and your own aversions. Every single time you do one of those things, you're reinforcing that ignorance and you're reinforcing those habits of craving, of desire and aversion. So keeping the precepts and practicing meditation is transforming you every day in the kind of person you are. And it's a gradual transformation. You might not even know how much you've changed until maybe you sit down and compare the way you are today with the way you used to be. Or you compare the way that you react to a situation with the way somebody else reacts to a situation. And then you realize how much you've changed. But these things change you, bring you to a place where when you hear the Dharma teachings, you know their truths. You understand their truth because you've changed in a way that now these things are becoming obvious. Then the ultimate thing in meditation is to come to that place where all of these insights come together and you have super mundane insights. You realize in a profound, very, very profound way that this whole sense of being a separate self is totally an illusion. And that the idea of the way other people are and the way the world is that you've been carrying around in your head all this time is just a projection of your mind based on your own ideas and conditioning experience. And that becomes really clear. When that becomes really clear, then you become transformed in a much deeper way. You become an Arya, and you become somebody who's on the paths to enlightenment, a stream entry or above.
Yeah. Just a technical question.
Yeah.
In the sitting meditation, that you sit still, and the breath that you observe is not a deep breath, just a normal breath that.
Yeah.
So should not take a deep breath. Normally, I
should not
deep breath.
Take a deep breath. The thing is to just let your body breathe naturally. I mean, all day long you're thinking about other things, and your body breathes naturally. So as much as possible, you want to just let your body breathe naturally. But if you have if you feel the urge for a deep breath, if you felt that urge for a deep breath while you were playing golf, you'd take a deep breath. So, if you feel that urge for a deep breath while you're meditating, take a deep breath. Then just observe it. Say, oh, there's that urge arising. There's a deep breath. The only thing that you don't want to do is to deliberately try to control your breath. So, because that's artificial. And the whole advantage of having the breath is it's something that's completely natural, constantly changing. One breath's a little longer, another breath's a little shorter. You know, and so you can practice just being the objective observer of your breath, which is practice for becoming the objective observer of your mind and of your life.
So try not to move, try minimize.
Yeah, as far as your body, just try to be as still, and especially try to discover the wonderful aspect of being still. the wonderfulness of being still. I know when you first start to sit, there's a lot of pain. But at the same time, when you sit down, you will, before the pain comes, or even in spite of the pain, you can appreciate the beauty and the calm of that stillness of the body. And you want to do that. You want to be aware of that. Then when you have to move, well, you have to move. It's all right. Just be mindful. Yeah?
This is not a question. I just want to see other people's feedback. The meditation, observing the breath, kind of resemble my childhood experience. Like, I kind of remember when I was very young, I'm like, why I'm breathing and my stomach is up and down, and I would lie on the bed and just move, look at my stomach, or just feel like, what is that for? Why my stomach is moving? And I said, okay, how about if I forgot to breathe? Would I die right. or something like that?
Yeah.
Like, why when we was young, we had that kind of nature, observe all the detailed things, but after we grow up, we lose it.
Yes, that's absolutely true, isn't it? We lose that appreciation for the most obvious basic things, like just breathing and being alive. That reminded me a little bit a story that is told about one of the meditation teachers in Thailand or Burma. I don't remember which one, but they had a Western student that came and he complained. He says, "I don't see what's so important about the breath. Why are we spending all these hours and hours looking at the breath?" And the teacher said, "Hold your breath." Breath, it's wonderful. It connects you with the whole world. You're taking in some of the world, and you're letting out some of the world. And it's spreading through your body, and it's keeping you alive, and everything. It's wonderful. Very basic. Okay, well, we've gone over time. I always go over time, so I'm sorry. But I thought it was a very good discussion, so I didn't mind going over time. What I'd like to do now is, you might need to stretch, you might need to go to the washroom or whatever. So do that, and then we'll sit together until 9 o'clock when the bell rings again. That's 42 minutes from now. So we'll just consider that the meditation begins now. So if you go to the washroom and come back, just come in quietly and sit down, okay? And we'll sit together till 9.